Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Yo, this is M1 from Dead Press.
Hey, what's up? This is Boots from The Coup.
Nah, I mean, telling you to stay tuned to Hard Knock Radio.
Keep it locked.
On the move, this is Pam Africa on Hard Knock Radio, the station of resistance. Down with this rotten-ass system.
Yo, check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one. News, views, and hip-hop.
Peace and love. This is Azeem. You're listening to Hard Knock Radio, real radio, from the concrete up. All the way to the sun. Keep shining, y'all. One love.
What's up, folks? This is your girl Femi representing the whole Bay Area. I'm here on Hard Knock Radio. News, views, and hip-hop. Stay tuned.
Good afternoon and welcome to Hard Knock here on the Pacifica Network. I'm Anita Johnson. The escalating threat of a white nationalist movement is upon us. Be it a Singletary racist remark about immigrants on social media, a pro-Trump rally in Berkeley, California, spearheaded by Nazi sympathizers, or the implementation of exclusionary policies that grossly impact America's poorest and most disenfranchised communities. The current political ideology of nativism, led by Donald Trump, Mike Pence, and Steve Bannon, is reshifting America's narrative back to a time of Andrew Jackson's vision of white nationalism. On today's program, I'll speak with Dr. Angelo Williams, a professor of sociology at Sacramento City and Sierra Colleges, about the normalization of white nationalism and the risk associated with it. First, Professor Williams, thank you so much for joining us today here on the program. As I said in my introduction, there's an attempt to normalize white supremacist thought by rebranding it as so-called alt-right or white nationalism. Is there a difference between a white supremacist and a white nationalist? Let's begin there.
I think there is. I think white supremacy and white nationalism share a particular kind of false narrative about history and also about anthropology, genetics, many things. But I think there is a difference between the two. I think that beyond the reframing, and that happens, I think, every decade or so, you'll remember when David Duke in the 80s was pretty much in the national political eye, and that was kind of the first attempt after the 50s and 60s of more of the blatant white supremacist, you know, points of view that were extra violent, clearly you know, marking a certain kind of racial territory, almost an ethnic cleansing of sorts, got rebranded by David Duke in terms of softer language and also a push for, you know, kind of the electoral, you know, chalice, if we could call it that, just the idea that these ideas, particularly him in the 80s, are more mainstream and more people believe them than they're letting on, and therefore would elect in Louisiana or New Orleans and many of the southern states those that represent those views. Mm-hmm. So the difference, I think, now, well, first of all, let me say that I think it's the same kind of rebranding. It's not a new trick. It's an old trick. Mm-hmm. And so alt-right definitely is the same kind of white supremacist, white nationalist points of view, the same kind of false narratives about history and genetics, all of that are wrapped into one. But the nationalists now are looking to deconstruct a government. I think that, you know, if you're looking at the Steve Bannons of the world, they have a particular kind of anarchic type of view that they wouldn't necessarily call white supremacy, but they would have a list of to-dos that include the destruction of the state as we know it, or as they would refer to it, as the deep state. You know, their sensibility is that government itself is the problem, and so to a certain extent, their sense of victory is you know, the ability to destroy the state itself, or to at least lessen its influence. And they believe, obviously, that the state is this liberal bastion that, you know, attempts to create winners and losers based upon some sort of ethnic, reverse ethnic hegemony, the idea that, you know, minorities then are more deserving than whites of particular kinds of largesse from the state. Mm-hmm. So I think they are different in terms of how we think about them, but they're also different in terms of the type of text that they reference and their goals, I think, at the end of the day.
Well, talk a bit about the purpose of rebranding in connection with the goal of having this type of rhetoric seem more palatable to a broader audience.
You know, here's the interesting part about this. There is a particular kind of generational rhetoric that does repeat itself as it relates to kind of nativist thought. The idea that one particular group, as opposed to diverse groups, are responsible for instance, the United States of America, or empire, or, you know, the greatest inventions of the world. It spawns back to this 500-year-old idea related to race itself, which is a misnomer. It is a very inarticulate and also false scientific narrative.
Right.
That basically established about 500 years ago that there were, in fact, only three races, Caucasoid, Mongoloid, Negroid. This is from this very outdated theory called the Theory of Oids, which basically established this racial hierarchy. Now, most people look at that as science as opposed to the propaganda of history. That scientific idea, the Theory of Oids, actually matched the colonial effort to not only rebrand but to dominate the world in a different kind of way. And the way that I like to explain it is, it's really simple. Gangsters like to take things, and then clever gangsters like to create reasons why they have more things than other people. And this is really the idea at the heart of white supremacy. And generationally, what happens is it comes through a kind of conversation about deprivation. And so many young white people looking at the spectrum now of African-American president and other ethnic groups, and also looking at the violence in European countries related to, at least in many people's minds, kind of, you know, ethnic immigration. They're looking for a reasoning related to that, and they pull for the most simplistic reasoning as opposed to the more complex picture of what's happening in the global world. So first off, what I like to do to help people on both sides of this conversation is try to direct them to text. What I mean by that is that white nationalism and white supremacy, at least from a social scientific point of view, is a false narrative about history. First and foremost, it's a single-sourced historical narrative, right? It's it's very unlike something like a Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, which shows that diversity, particularly when it comes to empire building, has actually been the grounding, right, of any kind of high level of civilization. It's never been one source of people. And even ethnicity within groups that are classified as one race are diverse. Also, one of the best books out today about this subject matter is by Dr. Neil Irving Painter. And the book is called The History of White People. And she really goes into depth to talk about the narrative of whiteness as a constructed reality. And so many white people, in fact, have been denied their ethnic roots and their ethnic background and kind of conglomerated into one white group, to the detriment, obviously, of different groups of people. There have been discrimination against ethnic whites all throughout American history, the Irish, Jewish Americans, Italian Americans. And that struggle for whiteness, that 100-year struggle in America from 1820 to 1920, actually saw many victims from so-called white communities based upon this kind of ethnic cleansing of whiteness. So at the end of the day, you know, a lot of what I try to get folks to do in the classroom is to study the sources, is to look at history and to look at the current situation as much more complex than some sort of single source history. But to answer your question around the generations, I think it's vital to look at what's happening with millennials, their sensibility around how the world is created, how things are constructed. And I think that generations theory, in another text, there's a book, interestingly enough, Steve Bannon is a fan of this book called The Fourth Turning. And it talks about this idea of cyclical history, and it talks about generations theory. So I think if you want to understand why much of this white supremacist rhetoric is on the rise, I would say look at the generations and the generational temperaments that are described in this text, because they give us a sense of why people are moving back towards more nativist and more simplistic reasoning for the social conditions that exist now.
All right. Moving forward and expanding this conversation to include our sitting president, Donald Trump. In many ways, people believe that his presidency has reinvigorated the white nationalist movement, be it through its rhetoric or policy. We can just look within his administration. You have Michael Alton, you have Jeff Sessions, you have Mike Pence, you mentioned Steve Bannon, all of whom occupy prominent positions in the present administration, all hold deep antagonism to immigrants, immigration, opposition to their equality within American society, and this nostalgia for a time when prosperity was specific to the native born. And frighteningly, this type of political ideology is being crafted by central members of the Trump inner circle who have adopted this Andrew Jackson vision of white nationalism as their own. Professor, your thoughts on Trump's vision of white nationalism as we see via policy and rhetoric, is it a political program that could potentially set America democracy back 150 plus years?
That's a great question. I think that first and foremost, I would like to say, you know, again, from a social scientific point of view, a lot of what we're doing is trying to look at, you know, the groundings, the roots of things, because you can figure out what's happening at the root of this issue, and you can really see, you know, the fruit. You can really see, okay, what is really happening here. So first and foremost, our white sisters and brothers actually have legitimate claims to the establishment. And oddly enough, their legitimate claims are exactly the same legitimate claims of working class blacks, working class Latinos, women, immigrants, those that have been left out of the system for the last 250 years. What is interesting about the scourge as it relates to opioids is that it is the same scourge related to crack cocaine in the 80s. It is the exact same conditions that surround people: hopelessness, joblessness, right? What happened in the industrial core of Detroit and what happened in the industrial core of Los Angeles, followed by, you know, the influx of drugs, in fact, created conditions for the epidemic, both in the 80s and now as it relates to opioids. So to me, what's interesting is that Donald Trump has taken legitimate hopes and aspirations of people who find themselves in similar conditions to African Americans and other minority groups in the 80s and capitalized on them. He's a poverty pimp.
Right.
At the end of the day, what he is selling them on, and really what he's being invigorated by, is a hope without a promise. When he says that I'm going to get your jobs back as it relates to coal, he knows he can't do that. He knows that the entire global system as it relates to this fossil fuel has been, let's skip the greenhouse effect. Let's just talk about natural gas. Natural gas as a commodity, right, has superseded the use and productivity of coal. I mean, so if you want to blame someone, right, blame natural gas. I mean, at the end of the day, if you want to look at the condition of people losing their jobs, yes, outsourcing is absolutely positively important. And if you want to have that conversation about immigrants, okay, let's just entertain that for a second. But here's the problem. In the last 50 years, what's actually happened in the industrial core is that robots, industrialization, has actually removed jobs that will never come back in Flint, Michigan, and Ohio, and all the rest of these places in the Rust Belt. So he's played the biggest trick on them because he's promised something that he can't deliver. And little by little, you're starting to see notions of buyer's remorse within the white community, within those folks that have actually voted for him. At the end of the day, I think what is most important for all of us is to keep our heads about us as it relates to the idea of division. We have lots in common with those in the Rust Belt economically and also politically. The question is, are we going to fall for the divide and conquer related to race and white supremacy, or are we going to look at the material conditions within our communities and say we should unite so that we can get what we need? Because it's clear Donald Trump, he's going to get what he needs.
Right.
He's going to get what he wants. His group is going to get what they want. But are the people going to get what they want? And if they follow this divide and conquer kind of technique, they won't.
What are your thoughts regarding his silence around the violence associated with people that follow him? In particular, I'm thinking about what took place this past weekend in Berkeley, where the pro-Trump rallies across the country. Throughout his campaign, he presented the thought that he would be a president of all Americans, but his policies and silence does little to combat the radicalization of these particular type of groups, be it Nazis. I'm thinking about neo-Nazis were here in Berkeley. Right? They showed up, and the police did very little to curb the level of violence that was perpetrated, you know, by these groups. So maybe if you can talk a bit about his silence, giving an okay and supporting this particular behavior.
I would, to me, what's fascinating as a sociologist looking at what happens in these crowds is some of the sociological and psychological reasoning that has been given to this kind of violence. More often than not, you know, it's contained under this theoretical idea, the contagion theory, right? It's the idea that crowds exert a hypnotic influence over their members, and that it's almost like childhood mimicry. People do what they see. So what's interesting is that the president is responsible at the end of the day for the mood of the country. I think he has tremendous kinds of power as it relates to quelling violence. And I think it doesn't help him at the end of the day. But I also think he's a politician. And I think that whether his hand is in it or not, his hand can be in it to solve it. And it can be in it to control or to calm people down. He did, after lots of pressure, say a few things about anti-Semitism. But I think that from a political point of view, unless he is pressured by outside groups to make strong statements about this, he won't. Frederick Douglass tells us this, you know, from history, right? You know, power concedes nothing without force. So it's up to groups who are affected by this kind of violence. And even the rhetoric that he uses, the very sloppy language that he uses that relates to ethnicity and race, his non-sensitivity to issues related to women, we have to call him on the carpet for that. We have to tell them that that is not the norm. Because when these situations break out, new norms actually are created. And this is where the problem is. If we allow these norms to be set in stone, then we allow the entire country to establish new norms where that kind of violence is okay. And the reason why those violent norms are not okay is because this is how lynchings happen. Yeah. This is how you can read, if you go back through historical, you know this, the historical record, and look at, you know, broadsheets, you know, newspapers from the you know, New York Times to, you know, the New York Observer, that literally are announcing a lynching, right? And that thousands of people were showing up to actually witness this as if it was a picnic.
Right.
This is the kind of norm that was established. I show this to some of my students and they say, how could this happen? Well, how does it happen? There's a norm that is broken around this kind of violence. No one says anything and it gets bigger and bigger. So to me, the voices of the people on all sides of this issue need to stand up loud and clear and force this president and force all of the, you know, normative value that we have as a people to push us into a different kind of reality. That's the only way it will stop.
Absolutely. How has the rise of white nationalism online corresponded with an increase of intimidation and violence in real life? And I bring up this question because, again, not just to solely focus on what happened in Berkeley, but I remember watching the video of the young African-American woman who was in at a rally who was being pushed by various pro-Trump supporters, you know,
yes.
And this is, I mean, it was a very intimidating situation, and no one came to her aid.
That's right.
So I wanted to kind of get your take on the way in which you see social media, this, you know, white nationalist online presence corresponding with an increase of intimidation and violence in real life.
That's a great observation. You know, just like when we're watching these crowds, you know, in person, and the contagion theory is at work, right? Really looking at collective behavior and how people kind of mimic this kind of collective behavior, really a kind of group peer pressure, and also kind of a resocialization, right? This is a lot of what's happening at these rallies. This is happening threefold on the internet.
Right.
And what here is, to me, is what's interesting. We are clear now, there are multiple studies talking about the idea of individuals being radicalized online. You know, there are lots of studies related to so-called radical Islamic terrorism and how, you know, individual American citizens have been radicalized by looking at, you know, a particular video or following a particular newsletter from ISIS. So if this is true on that side, it's absolutely true on the white supremacist side. We can look no further than Dylann Roof. He tells
excellent point.
Right? He tells us that his association with white supremacist groups online, in fact, pushed him further into those groups and therefore created the conditions for the actions that he was taking. Before he drew the gun and shot people, he showed up in a photo with the kind of white supremacist bona fides in terms of patches and gear to show the rest of the group that he was associating with that he was in fact a part of them. Here's an interesting thing about this. The idea of social isolation really does push people into groups that they may or may not want to be a part of, but that in fact feed a particular kind of human need to be a part of a group. We are not, from a sociological point of view, individuals. We actually are part wholes. We are a part of every group we are born into and we connect with and we affiliate with. So the power of social media from a positive point of view can help us to affiliate with our strongest and held values related to humanity and humanism and care and concern. But of course, at the same time, they can also push us into those dark corners and to groups that will create the conditions as a group for possible violence.
That is the voice of Professor Williams. He's a professor of sociology at Sacramento City and Sierra Colleges. We're talking a bit about the normalization of white nationalism and the risk associated with it. Moving forward, because you talked a bit about media and your conversation around lynching and them almost promoting it at a particular period of time in our country or in the history of the United States. But how do you view the media's responsibility in engaging with the so-called alt-right and other groups associated with white nationalism and white supremacy?
You know, my opinion on this may be highly unpopular, but I stand by it because I really do believe in freedom of speech and freedom of expression. Our problem at this particular moment is conglomerate control of the media. you know, at the end of the day, we need more forces in resistance, because to me, that resistance actually gives a particular kind of instructive voice, or at least a counterpoint in a dialectic around speech. Because when the conversation dissipates, when there's no more talking, when there's no more back and forth, the problem is that this is usually when violence breaks out. So we have a problem with this control of media. We have too few hands controlling media, radio, television, all of the rest. So the voices get muted. Then on top of that, when we look at social media, usually it's a one-way conversation. And so no one is calling for these different and disparate groups to come together. What people are trying to do is to create allegiances around information as opposed to intelligent, intellectual debate, a give and take reasoning around information. And so we dial on to our favorite channel, our favorite news station, our favorite website, and we are fed a particular set of values. We are fed a particular set of ideas, as opposed to those ideas really being questioned at the heart of it. So when it comes to these white supremacist groups, a lot of what needs to happen is a certain kind of dialectical imposition of information other than what they're receiving. When we say that white supremacy is a false narrative, a part of what we're saying is that that's not how history works. That's not how groups work. That's not even the history of white people itself. That's a false narrative. Now, the problem is that, you know, we're in the midst of a battle for truth and for reasoning within the public square, within the secular square. The idea that something is the truth now is being questioned. But if you notice, in every fascist regime that has ever risen in history, the number one area that is questioned first and control is sought is through the media. And a part of what fascist regimes have done throughout the world is to create a lot of question around what is the truth. They're attempting to cause this core confusion. And the problem is that most people rely on these sources of media for their information, as opposed to having the tools of research to get the information themselves. So part of what I teach in my class is to get students to understand how to be good consumers of information, how to fact check, how to find those sources, how to dig deeper into the information that they are receiving. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, if we don't take personal responsibility for the information that we're taught, if we just blithely, right, take the information that we're given from whatever source we are, if we just agree that that's the truth as opposed to questioning it from jump, then we will be led like sheep over the ledge.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to be clear. You believe, and you make a very interesting point, and I agree with you to some extent, but I just want to be clear on that. You're saying that you believe that the need to cover these groups in the news outweighs the risk of normalizing their beliefs. Do I understand you correctly?
I think that they should be covered. I think that they should speak. I absolutely think that they have a right to say whatever they want to say. Mm-hmm. I also believe that we have the right to a counterpoint. We have a right to actually fact check. We have a right to present and also magnify those ideas that we think are different from theirs.
What should people look for in terms of the way in which we should be processing how we normalize something that at some point wasn't normal to do so, and then also the way in which media covers this or the conversation that's being had on media about white nationalism?
Mm-hmm. I think on the normative level, right? And this is what I mean by that. When I say that I believe that they have the right to say what they need to say and believe whatever they believe, I'm not saying that I am in support of the groups or their level of information. I'm saying on my side, I feel like I have a right to critique them, have a right to present counterfacts, and have a right to resist them. And also, if I don't do all of those things, then I am allowing a particular kind of normative reality. Here's the issue. The issue is that when people stay silent, right, that's when the norms set in. When a white supremacist comment or a white supremacist rally or a white supremacist idea is left unchecked, is left, right, unbalanced, mm-hmm. then that's when the norms set in.
Okay.
When we don't resist, when we don't respond, when we don't try to get into a reasoned debate, when we don't show up at the rally or show up at the debate or show up in the conversation, the silence is the norm.
Okay.
And that's the problem. The problem is that too few people who have these, for lack of a better term, progressive or liberal or just freedom-oriented, at least from my point of view, their voices are the most silent. Their voices are the ones in the backdrop. And it's that silence that's become the norm. That silence actually has led the Democratic Party for the last 50 years further and further right. Right? It's that silence that has seen progressive movements fall by the wayside by 100 or 2,000 votes. The real question is, those people who actually believe in those core values, humanism, the idea that people have the right to not only protest but to assemble, that there is a social safety net, that the rights of immigrants and women and African Americans and others are important, those people need to get louder. They are silent at this moment, and their silence has become the norm.
Let me push back a little bit. How much of that silence, normalizing that silence, is fostered in the belief that this is an immigrant problem or an issue, or that this is an issue that Black people need to speak out against? Because
right. In
listening to Tim Weiss last night, he was very clear that this is an America that Trump is helping to foster, that white people mm-hmm. who know better are silent
right.
regarding
right.
his policy and the way in which he's implementing this particular brand of white supremacy. Maybe if you can speak
right.
to that.
Well, here's the interesting part about American history. Most folks were upset when Donald Trump was elected. Maybe four semesters before, I started teaching this section in class, and it started out with the question, or basically with the statement, Donald Trump will be president. Why? Right? And so, there's a chapter in our text around deviance. And the idea is that deviants bring society together. They create the outer limit of where society is, right? And in fact, they attract people who believe in breaking the rules, which is a norm in and of itself, right? So, the cliche that we often hear, it's a bit misogynistic, but why do good girls love bad boys? Or why does the guy with the jacket and the Harley and the cigar poking out of his mouth, why does he get the most street cred? Because he creates the outer limit, and people think, like this Superman theory, that this person can do things that other people can't do, so they're going to follow them. They have power. Now, here's the problem. The problem is that Donald Trump actually represents, if you look, you remember that ruler or that little piece of paper that they gave you with all the presidents, and right now we're looking at Donald Trump and Obama. But if you look at Obama back, Donald Trump is more like the rest of those presidents than Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of presidents, Southerners, the majority of presidents, slaveholders. So let's be real about American history. Let's be real about the idea that this idea of white supremacy is rife throughout American history, that it is a false narrative, but it's a powerful narrative. It's a false narrative, but it's a narrative that has controlled the country. So a part of the reason why I say those that are silent and know better need to say more is because the kind of work is hand-to-hand combat. And I don't mean that taking up of arms. I mean it's hand-to-hand combat in your communities, in your families, at the dinner table. White people need to take on white people in their communities about these beliefs, about the things that they let slide in conversation at the water cooler, in these ideas that they have about particular groups of people, even in the idea that America is solely a country based in immigration. America is not a country based solely in immigration. It's based on colonization and immigration. What I mean by that is that there are three core colonial groups. What I mean by that is this is an empire that was founded on the land of Native Americans, on the land of Mexican nationals, and on the labor of Africans brought here. Those people are not immigrants. Those people are colonized, and their condition is reflective of that. Immigrant groups have come in on the backs of that and literally continue to have the same kinds of problems those colonized groups have had, but there's a vast difference between the two. So a lot of the education around what our country really is needs to happen at those dinner tables. It needs to happen at that soccer field. The soccer moms need to get together and ask themselves questions about Black Lives Matter, right? They need to ask themselves questions, because here's the deal. What happens to those colonized groups, and this is the truth of America, what happens in those colonized groups is the canary in the coal mine of what's going to happen to the rest of America writ large. We already see this in what's happening with the opioid crisis, right? That opioid crisis showed up in Black America as the crack cocaine condition.
But it was never called crisis as well. Not to interrupt you.
Never, exactly. No. Don't get me wrong. They were treated differently.
Right.
And because they weren't seen, because we weren't seen as human beings.
Right.
Right. Because we weren't seen as having human license. Right. You know, even to this day, the phrase crack baby still exists. Mm-hmm. Nobody's calling anybody an opioid baby. Right.
Right.
So we know that there is some real racial and racialized dissonance between the two. But if we don't see that what happens in South Central, what happens in Detroit, what happens in predominantly Black, Latino, Native American communities will show up writ large in America, then we're missing, right? We're missing an opportunity to stave off those troubles, right? In the Bible, it says, right, what you do to the least of these. And so a lot of what our issue is as a country, as a national entity, is that we look at some groups as unhuman or non-human. We create a kind of tiered response. We don't have to be emotional about drive-by shootings. But then when Diebold and the other guy who shows up at Columbine, and they're doing the basic same things related to those drive-by killers in 1983, when that happens in 1999, we don't even put it together.
Right.
It's the same crisis within young men. They just happen to be of different races, of different backgrounds, but they're challenged by similar conditions. Because at the end of the day, all of these racial and racialized and ethnic groups in America are under particular kinds of economic and social conditions that at the end of the day create winners and losers, the 1% and the 99%. And at the end of the day, if people don't understand that this divide and conquer technique between ethnicity and race helps some people and hurts others, and those people that are fomenting this kind of division actually, they literally make change, make money, make their wealth of our division, then we're lost.
That is the voice of Dr. Angelo Williams, a professor of sociology at Sacramento City and Sierra Colleges, and serves as the deputy director of the California Black Health Network. Dr. Williams is a published author with articles in The Source, Vibe, Rap Pages, and the Sacramento Observer. He is the co-author of Healthy Black People, an advocacy training guide. He joined us today by phone from Sacramento, California. Professor Williams, is there a way that people can get in contact with you, follow you on social media, and so on?
Yes, absolutely. My Twitter handle is Angelo A. Williams, just all one word. CBHN, which is the California Black Health Network, our page is cablackhealthnetwork.org.
Again, that is Professor Dr. Angelo Williams. He's a professor of sociology at Sacramento City and Sierra Colleges. Today, we spoke with him about white nationalism and the dangers associated with normalizing this type of rhetoric. Again, this is Hard Knock Radio. I'm Anita Johnson. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock Radio. East, west, north, south, conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous, speaking to the thugs. One love, we know where y'all at. Top, Brown Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415s bumping Hard Knock Radio. Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. And to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from these hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the poor cops. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side. Learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the poor cops. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side. We'll be right back.
the religious, political? In the academy, one is confronted with a plethora of departments, disciplines, which, while ostensibly united under the aegis of the institution we call the university, these very sectional divisions betray not similarity, but difference. This is actually not surprising, given the very different theoretical bases upon which these various disciplines developed, not to mention the purposes that these disciplines serve in that catch-all phrase we call society. Stuart Hall's Recollections of the Development of Cultural Studies reveals a study of conflict in which internal and external forces, that is to say, institutional elements within the university and activist forces from without, strove to either abolish cultural studies as an unwanted interloper or enter it and fundamentally transform it by radical theories of race consciousness or insurgent feminism. Hall's writing reports feminist intrusion was conceived of as breaking in to the pristine house of cultural studies. An interesting quote indeed would suggest that a crime, breaking and entering, was committed and cultural studies was victimized. Hall, 1992-6. One here refers to this disciplinary origin story to lay bare the bones of the academic enterprise, and by extension, to excavate how institutions develop, grow, and transform in form and function to keep pace with the social transformations. As an example of such institutional transformation, we need look no further than American academia's finest and oldest continuous educational institution, Harvard University. Founded in 1636 as Harvard College, its primary function was the training of Puritan ministers. At last count, at least 7 U.S. presidents have studied at Harvard, and its religious origins have largely been forgotten. Today, it is regarded as a sentinel of secularism, high rationality, and a credential that all but assures success. For politicians, it is a credential that radiates power, intellect, and competence. This example illustrates how an institution born to serve a religious purpose may transform over time to serve a political one. Institutions change, so does society. It is also certain that there is no true correlation between progress and rationality. Human beings often hold on to ideas learned in infancy and adolescence that remain in consciousness. This may be seen in religious notions that survive into adulthood and into senescence of divinity, of afterlife, that resists rationality. Connolly informs us that cognition and judgment filters through a process of layered intricacy, where one's perception results from an interplay of emotional impact and memory. Connolly explains, the visceral register of subjectivity and intersubjectivity, as I will call it, is at once part of thinking, indispensable to more conceptually refined thinking, a periodic spur to creative thinking, and a potential impediment to rethinking. Connolly 3. Connolly's term, visceral register, suggests the feeling arising from the gut, the viscera. In this sense, we are responding to deep levels of feeling, instinct, a kind of gut knowledge. Our politics, by contrast, are often inherited or learned, more often than not, passed on, like religion, from one's elders or caregivers. And while political perspective may be influenced by familial and even early life exposures, Connolly suggests that one's political perspective doesn't reach the psychic depth of one's visceral register. This may be why political ideas are more receptive to developmental transformation wrought by increased intellectual or educational stimuli than religious notions informed by emotional input. One can change one's ideas with sufficient data, but it seems more challenging to change one's feelings. Similarly, while maturity itself brings with it more nuanced and sophisticated thinking as we enter adulthood, these core themes of life, death, God, devil, good, evil, heaven, hell, may prove more resistant to extinction. This sense of duality lies deep in human consciousness, as it is the very premise of elementary learning, as in thing A is not thing B. Or more to the point, life exists, why not afterlife? Or God exists, why not the devil? Durkheim seems to support this supposition thus, quote, "Religious phenomena is such that it always assumes a bipartite division of the universe, known and knowable, into two genera that include all that exists, but radically exclude one another." Durkheim, 38. We see this duality as the sacred and the profane, and given the plebeian origins of Christianity and its expansion into what we consider European culture, that duality found expression in the belief that religion was sacred, politics, because worldly, was profane. Until, of course, it wasn't. For when the Roman Emperor Constantine adopted the Christian faith, he transformed Christianity as surely and certainly as Christianity transformed Rome. For the church, born of oppressed Jews in the backwaters of the empire, became Roman, became Catholic, which means universal, imperial. Its tongue became Latin, not the Aramaic of Jesus. The cardinals and popes wore robes of power, not humility. And the Bishop of Rome took titles formerly used by the Emperor of Rome, such as Pontifex Maximus, that's Latin for Supreme Pontiff, commonly referred to today as Pope. The historian Gibbon tells us the pontiffs were chosen among the most illustrious of the senators, and the office of Supreme Pontiff was constantly exercised by the emperors themselves. They knew and valued the advantages of religion as it is connected with civil government. Gibbon, 38. Gibbon here refers to the so-called pagan Roman Empire, where religion was a tool of state. When Roman elites took Christianity as a state religion, and when the church took temporal power from the middle of the 8th century until the latter half of the 19th century, the pontiff held temporal as well as spiritual power. Wherever there is temporal power, there is also politics, no matter how or why it is realized. The Pope was a political actor, and his tool of state was the place assigned to his office by religious tradition. Yes, even pagan religious traditions. But if our subject here is religion, we must go just a bit further. Islam, a chronological descendant of Christian and Jewish traditions, was led in its formation by a man who was not merely a prophet, but a warrior, and also a lawgiver. The former merchant was also, in a very real sense, a political figure who built an extraordinary set of beliefs that merged and meshed the numerous tribes of Arabia into what may be seen as a mega-tribe based not on blood, but belief. That mega-tribe is today, over a millennium after its founding, known as Muslims or believers, and its prophet, Muhammad ibn Abdullah. Over 1.6 billion people on earth are Muslims today. Is the religious political? Anything that mobilizes millions of people is, by its very nature, political. When we try to separate religion from politics, it's like trying to separate, well, wetness from water. For approaches to comparative cultural studies too, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
On the move. I want to thank Mr. Louis Farrakhan and a million more for the kind invitation to join y'all here.
as we gather in person or electronically. We do so in a time of peril. We do so in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, when the state showed us all that they don't give a damn about black lives.
Angry leaders that frame Lumia are the same names blamed for Hurricane Katrina. See, the levees would break, the waters would crush, and President Bush, he would forsake the poor and oppressed. So just from the smaller Katrinas, we experience a deadly effects in all arenas. Every year, public schools miseducate the poor, destroying any chance to advance and get more, man. Taxes pay for the oppression we experience. Police too brutal for me to mention. It gets really tense. Consumers of the media filled with ignorance, poisoning our minds with gimmicks and violent images. The daily hurricanes of hate and indifference experience behind the prison gate on some condition. The courthouse laws and rules they reveal are threats to our welfare and not tools of our will, so just.
But every day of our lives, we see small, but no less lethal, Hurricane Katrinas. Every year, in public schools, millions of black, Latino, and poor kids are miseducated, thereby destroying, as surely as any hurricane, their life hopes and chance.
Hey. We need the boom in the millions to bring true social power to civilians. Don't gotta swallow the bullshit from the one that you follow and free your mind from the mud that you wallow in. Hey, from the confusion of social repression and destitution, there is only one solution to this intrusion. The movement of millions to bring forth a revolution. Now who's in? Those engaged in the struggle for freedom and justice and the liberation of political prisoners. We need those dedicated to change so that rich and poor children are educated the same. Yeah, we need the movement to resist the fraction that brought you patriot acts but not patriotic actions. We need the movement that ignites, not divides us, despite all the trauma. Cause my people are survivors.
We need a movement of millions to build true social power, to free our minds and our bodies from the mud that we languish in. We need a movement of millions to transform our current social reality of repression and destitution. We need a movement of millions to bring back light to the eyes of our people, to engage in a struggle for freedom, for justice, and for liberation. We need a movement of millions of the poor, of workers, of women, of youth, of students, of prisoners, of all those dedicated to change, to build independent organizations that can't be bought or sold, and will do the work necessary to be free.
Hard Knock Radio, East, West, North, South, conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous, speaking to the thugs. One love, we know where y'all at. Top, Brown Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415s bumping Hard Knock Radio, Brown Buffalo. All up in your stereo. Yo, and to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from these hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks, learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side, learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks, learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side.
Past the movement, my lessons from my past, the movement.